This is a report about a rare opportunity to observe firsthand the leadership and the people, the problems and the progress of this communist island nation, and an even rarer opportunity, a wide-ranging exclusive interview with Fidel Castro. You will see and hear the Cuban leader talking about President Ford, former President Nixon, Secretary of State Kissinger, Chile and the CIA, the future, as Castro sees it, of capitalism and communism in the Western Hemisphere. In his opinion, where we are and where we may be going in terms of United States-Cuba relations. We also will show you some of what everyday life is like today in Cuba and how Fidel Castro governs it. Dan Rather for CBS Reports.
CBS Reports. Castro, Cuba, and the USA.
Last July, Cuban Premier Fidel Castro, who had not allowed himself to be interviewed in depth for United States television since 1968, granted an extended interview to a United States independent television production team from Washington, D.C. That team was made up of Frank Mankiewicz, Kirby Jones, and Saul Lando. Earlier this month, this reporter returned to Cuba with the same trio to update the Castro interview in light of recent important developments, developments that refocused world attention on this island country and the future of U.S. relations with Cuba.
During both visits, the base, the footing of Fidel Castro's revolution appeared to be more secure than ever. The man and his movement now tower over and dominate Cuba completely.
Lo que se derrumba no es la revolución cubana, sino el imperio yanqui.
Castro is one of the most powerful political orators of his time, a spellbinder. But talk alone does not a lasting revolution make. As he himself keeps saying, Cuba is a small place, only a speck on the map of Latin America. But the fact that his unique brand of nationalism combined with communism has survived, and that he has survived, has made him a force to be reckoned with throughout the hemisphere. The Cuban Revolution now is 15. Fidel, Cubans seldom call him anything but Fidel, is 47. He looks younger, partly because of his most dominant physical characteristic up close, his eyes. Brown, alert, frequently darting, always expressive. That is, of course, when you can see them through the cigar smoke. He says he's tried to cut down on his smoking. The only noticeable difference is that he fires up fewer big cigars, more smaller ones. He still dresses constantly in guerrilla warfare greens. Most other Cubans don't. His are now carefully tailored, always freshly pressed. His body is large compared with those of other Cubans, over 6 feet tall, more than 200 pounds. Says he's been losing weight, down 25 pounds in the past year. No special diet, he says, just eating less. He still wears a sidearm wherever he goes. That's number one assistant Jose Pepin Naranjo, helping him off with his pistol belt. Pepin, little known outside Cuba, is one of the most powerful men in the country. First secretary of the Communist Party in Havana, Pepin is to Fidel a bit of what Bob Haldeman was to Richard Nixon. Besides guns, Fidel loves gadgets of all kinds. Classy cigar lighters, digital watches, fancy cameras. There is, in many ways, a boyish quality to this Marxist dictator, but 650,000 Cubans fled, most because they could not live under what they insist is his economic and political tyranny. And they insist that visitors are often too easily taken in by Castro's personality and the appearances of unity and solidarity. I can only tell you what a skeptical reporter saw and heard and felt on and away from Castro's own guided tours. We were allowed to move freely, with and without guides. And the impression was that among those Cubans who remain, Castro is overwhelmingly popular. He is seemingly at ease wherever he goes, whether popping into some stranger's apartment just to escort visiting reporters through showcase housing, or wandering the new combination manual labor and study schools he has built. He's a great toucher. Yes, touching is the traditional Latin way, but even taking that into full account, Castro has a special knack and like for touching, patting, squeezing all he meets. Security around him is light. Only a few armed bodyguards, and Fidel's own Soviet-made AK-47 automatic rifle is always mounted on the dashboard of his Jeep. Traveling around with him for a day, one finds that he is well-read, a good listener as well as talker. When he talked in public recently, before 200,000 on the 14th anniversary of the Committees to Defend the Revolution, he strongly attacked the United States and its policies.
La confirmación plena y confesa de la participación del gobierno de los Estados Unidos.
He charges the U.S. government with full and confessed responsibility for the overthrow and death of Chile's late President Allende. The crowd responds with a chant. Right on, Fidel. Give it to the Yankees hard. But in private, his words about America are softer. Our interview with the Cuban leader took place October 2nd, after midnight, in the premier study at the Presidential Palace. No questions were submitted in advance. Dr. Castro responded to every question put to him, including those about the new President of the United States.
What is your impression of President Ford, so far as you can determine what he is like and what he is doing?
Mi impresión personal.
It seems to me that during the first days, he acted with great caution, with much discretion. It seems to me that he found almost unanimous support in the United States. However, as you know, some things have happened afterwards. I have read a good deal of criticism because of the pardon of Nixon. I also think that this posed a moral problem, because it is difficult to understand that Nixon be pardoned and all the rest of the people be left to be punished. This does not seem to be very just. Afterwards, but this is of course a matter of the internal policy of the United States, I imagine that there must have been certain reasons for taking this decision. Of course, it was a bit surprising that it broke the unanimity that was observed regarding Ford. From the point of view of foreign policy, from ours, according to our criteria, there are two statements that concern us. One was his justifying statement on the intervention of the CIA in Chile. And the other was his speeches in the United Nations and in Detroit on the energy issue, in which he used what seems to us very strong pressuring language, and in a certain form threatening to the oil-producing countries. This reflected a certain political style from positions of strength. These two international events are to us, to the Cubans, to the Latin Americans, to the countries of the Third World, something that worries us. Of course, on the other hand, he has made other statements favoring the continuation of the policy of international détente, which we regard as positive pronouncements. Now, since we are speaking of Ford, I will indicate a positive fact. He is not involved with the Cuban counter-revolutionary elements. Nixon was personally very much involved with them. And we have seen in Ford a man who is above this, these relations of friendship. And of course, because we think that the policy of a large and powerful nation such as the United States cannot be determined by reason of personal bonds with a certain people, in our opinion, from the Cuban point of view, we see Ford as, with a certain hope, in the sense that he may, after all, adopt a different policy towards Cuba, and that at least he does not have the personal involvement that Nixon had in this regard. This is a positive point that can be pointed out from the Cuban angle.
But his advisor, his principal foreign policy advisor, President Ford, remains the same as President Nixon's, Secretary Kissinger.
Kissinger? Sí.
Kissinger, yes. But it seems to us that there was not always total agreement between the policy of Kissinger and the policy of Nixon.
Vaya.
You see, I do not believe that Kissinger has a personal position that is hostile towards Cuba, while Nixon undoubtedly had a personal hostility position towards Cuba. He transformed the problem into a personal one, and it seems to me that the principal obstacle to any change in the policy towards Cuba was Nixon, not Kissinger. Besides, Kissinger has shown himself to be a realistic politician who undoubtedly has fought for international détente. And I must say that the positive facts that Nixon has shown in international policies are to a large extent also to be attributed to Kissinger.
What about Dr. Kissinger's involvement in the CIA activities in Chile?
Well, according to the American press, he was the president of the Council of Advisors, or a Committee of 40. The Committee of 40, and according to this information, he has a responsibility for this CIA participation in Chile. We have read that in the papers. The fact is, of course, that this is a blow to his prestige. It is a blow because international public opinion certainly always regarded Kissinger as a man of peace. And this episode in Chile is considered as an act in contradiction with the opinion held of him internationally. It seems to me that this affects his prestige. And I have not the least doubt about this. But it could also have happened that his enemies might try to exploit, that is, the enemies of international détente, might try to take advantage of this episode to weaken Kissinger's position and to combat Kissinger's policy. In spite of all, and in spite of it being very lamentable that he might have had any part in the events in Chile, I believe that he is no doubt the most realistic politician and who has made the greatest effort to find a solution to the Cold War problems in recent years in the United States.
We ask Premier Castro for his impressions of Watergate and President Nixon's resignation.
Actually, my impression is that it was very serious from a legal point of view and from the moral point of view. It seems to me that after all, you found a correct formula to liquidate the matter. It seems to me that the spectacle of a trial would have been something rather hard for the United States. And I think that in spite of Nixon's resistance, the pressures exerted on him to convince him to resign brought about, it seems, results. I believe you resolved it in a correct manner.
Frank Mankiewicz commented that it was an irony of history that Cuban exiles such as Barker and Martinez had been involved in the Watergate scandal.
Well, they are in prison or indicted. Yet, it is certain that Nixon had very good relations with all these people. And it is the irony of history that these people who were prepared to conspire against the Cuban Revolution were unable to destroy the Cuban Revolution, but they were able to destroy Nixon.
On April 17, 1961, a U.S.-trained force of about 1,400 exiles invaded Cuba in an attempt to overthrow Castro. These CIA-sponsored soldiers were blessed aboard the invasion fleet before landing at the Bay of Pigs. The operation was a disaster. Castro, in personal command of Cuban forces, easily repelled the attack. Many of the invaders were killed. The rest were made prisoner, captured with comparative ease. Their large supply of American weapons was seized. The Cuban premier now says that Richard Nixon not only supported the invasion at the Bay of Pigs, but actually wanted to use United States armed forces in it to ensure its success.
Nixon proposed, even to Eisenhower, that this method be used against us and defended it. And when, in the middle of the Bay of Pigs crisis, Kennedy consulted Nixon, Nixon, according to his own words, proposed that the armed forces of the United States be used. This was Nixon's advice. Kennedy did not take it. It should not be forgotten that Kennedy had taken a courageous stand in those days. When everyone was blaming each other, he said that success has many fathers, but defeat is an orphan. And he assumed the responsibility for all that had happened. Of course, this was undoubtedly a courageous stand on his part.
Commandante, there's been some confusion, at least in public opinion in the United States, as to what you consider to be the minimum conditions for reestablishing some kind of relationship with the United States.
I would say that number one is the lifting of the economic blockade, because the economic blockade is an act of force, an act of coercion, which the United States exerts against us, because it employs all its international influence, all its political strength, and all its economic power, trying to asphyxiate the Cuban economy. And this policy has affected us for many years. And we regard this as an extremely hostile act against us. And therefore, we have established our position that we are not disposed to negotiate under conditions of economic blockade. And in order to start discussing all the differences and all the problems as one would like, it is necessary to meet one condition: that the economic blockade is stopped. When the economic blockade is ended, we shall be in a condition to speak on the conditions of equality, the United States and ourselves. The United States not only refuses to trade with us, but it takes punitive measures against the ships that come to Cuba, against the countries that trade with Cuba. Now, here you have a recent example. For example, Bangladesh, a small country with 50 million inhabitants that has suffered a great natural catastrophe, enormous floodings, which is in need of food. Then the United States, in order to grant Bangladesh certain shipments of foodstuffs, I believe 100,000 tons of wheat and some other foodstuffs, it set as condition to Bangladesh that it break its commercial relations with Cuba. Actually, it is a great shame that in order to be able to extend a certain assistance to a country very much in need of it, you impose on it a harsh condition, a humiliating condition. Once the blockade stops, then we can start discussing all the other problems as may be desired. Because there are problems that are of interest to us. There is the Guantanamo base. It is one of the problems to be discussed. Guantanamo is a piece of the national territory of Cuba. It is occupied by the United States. But we do not say that in order to start discussions, they must withdraw from Guantanamo. Rather, we have posed a single condition: that the economic blockade be stopped.
In the interview last July, Premier Castro told Frank Mankiewicz and Kirby Jones how he believes better relations between Cuba and the United States will finally come about.
I do not know when the United States will change its present regime of free enterprise, for a different one, a socialist regime. I am certain of one thing, that it will take decades, surely many decades, but one day the economic and social system of the United States will change. And I am also sure that the economic social system of Cuba will never turn back. One day the social systems of Cuba and the United States will meet when the U.S. changes its social regime. The capitalistic social regime is not eternal and will not be eternal. Of course, I am convinced that the last country in the world where a change towards socialism will take place is the United States, because the free enterprise institutions wield great power in the United States, because it is the country where capitalism has given the maximum results, where capitalism has gone the farthest, and where the greatest economic and technological achievements have been realized.
In Havana Harbor, where the U.S. battleship Maine was sunk in 1898 as a prelude to the brief Spanish-American War, occasionally now Soviet warships make courtesy calls. Soviet freighters fulfill the agreements of the Cuba-Soviet Union alliance. One sees few Russians on the streets and in hotels and restaurants, but the file of fully laden ships, the piles of unloaded cargo, foodstuffs and other supplies, and the technicians on the docks are ample evidence of a Soviet presence and influence. Castro talks proudly of Cuba's friendship and the economic alliance with Russia. In his earlier interview with Frank Mankiewicz and Kirby Jones, the Prime Minister was asked, what are the relations between Cuba and the Soviet Union? How can they be defined?
I know that the Soviet politicians are consistent in their ideas about the necessity of international détente and about peaceful coexistence, and we, on the other hand, have unlimited trust in them. We have complete confidence in the loyalty of the Soviet leadership towards the Cuban Revolution, and we have never had any concern whatsoever to this effect. We know that the Soviets are absolutely loyal in their relations with Cuba, and we have never had the slightest worry because we have faith in them. This is the truth. Of course, to us, the solidarity of the Soviet Union has been of very great importance. We have received from the Soviet Union large-scale aid in every respect, which has been decisive for us in this struggle against the blockade. You only have to look, for example, at the very problem of fuel supplies, which has been a very serious problem for many countries. We had no energy crisis. We had no blockade of fuel supplies. And during these 15 years, our country continued to receive from the Soviet Union all the fuel it consumes, year in and year out. During all these years, our country received from the Soviet Union the wheat it consumes. It received a lot of transportation equipment, agricultural equipment, industrial equipment. All the development of our electric power supply has been carried out essentially with Soviet equipment, and today we produce three times as much electrical power as we did before the triumph of the revolution. Our mechanical industry has also been developing with the assistance of the Soviet Union, and in addition, food supplies, many food products. We receive fertilizers, raw materials, and a whole series of essential products. So that for us, the aid given by the Soviet Union during these years of blockade and of crisis has been decisive. This is the situation. While we were subjected to aggression from the United States during these 15 years, from them we received aid. We have had insuperable proof of the spirit of friendship and of solidarity on the part of the Soviet Union. How can our relations with the Soviet Union be compared with the relations that existed with the United States? The Soviet Union has extended to us payment facilities. It has granted us large credits. And whenever the circumstances of a financial order required it, it has always displayed the best attitude towards us. The United States owned our mines. The United States was the owner of our electric power plants, of our telephone companies, of the main transportation companies, of the principal industries, of the best lands, of the largest sugar mills. They owned our banks. They owned our foreign trade. In a few words, they owned the Cuban economy. The Soviets do not own a single mine in Cuba, not a single factory, not a single sugar mill, not 1 acre of land, not a single bank, not a single business, not a single utility. So then all the natural resources, all the industries, and all the means of production belong to our country. And before the revolution, they were under the ownership of another country. But it was really fortunate for us that a country with resources such as the Soviet Union would have the inclination and the will to help us. Otherwise, we could not have made it through those so very difficult years.
There's a bound of Che Guevara, Argentine-born guerrilla strategist who helped Castro win against Batista. Che went to Bolivia in 1967, was killed there trying to carry out a Castro-style guerrilla war. Che's way failed. Now Castro talks more of conciliation and trade. Indeed, while keeping Che's memory alive in Cuba, Castro is pushing elsewhere an economic union of all Latin American nations. Dr. Castro was asked if he now favors some new union of Latin American countries.
The United States is a large community. Western Europe is a large community. The USSR and the socialist camp of Europe is a large community. China is a large community. And in the future, only the large communities will be in a position to face the great problems humanity has before it. And we, the Latin American peoples, have a community of language, of culture, of tradition, and we are peoples who must unite in the same way as the states of North America united, and we shall form a large community. And if the United States had not been a large community, it would not have been able to achieve the industrial successes, the scientific successes, the economic successes it has attained. So we believe that we must work to create a community.
Considering what happened to Allende and in Chile, do you see any possibility of anyone else in Latin America electing what you would consider to be a social reform government?
Sí, yo entiendo.
Yes, I understand.
Mire, Allende y la Unidad Popular.
Look, Allende and the Popular Unity Front of Chile tested the possibility of making a change by peaceful means and by parliamentary means. Actually, Allende was very respectful of parliament. He was very respectful of the opposition parties and was very respectful of the opposition press and of the constitution and of the laws. It is absolutely false and absolutely baseless that Allende tried to establish a single party, that Allende tried to destroy the opposition parties, that Allende tried to destroy the opposition press, and that Allende tried to destroy parliament. I knew Allende very well, and I can assure you that Allende scrupulously respected the law, the constitution, and the institutions of Chile. It is simply a lie to try and justify the intervention that took place there in Chile. Allende tried to carry out social reforms with a parliament, with the parties, and through absolutely legal and absolutely peaceful means. And what they did was to conspire to obstruct the government, to sabotage its work, and in the end, violate the constitution, cause a coup d'etat, assassinate Allende, establish there a regime of terror, of the most cruel ones known in the history of this hemisphere. And I believe that to make a revolution, you need the people. And force is also needed. And power is needed. The power of arms is needed. I am going to cite an example to you. Peru, great social changes are taking place in Peru. In Peru, a revolutionary process has been going on for 6 years. And why can this process be carried on? Because the Peruvian revolutionary government counts on the support of the armed forces, counts on the support of arms, and can go on carrying through all these changes. What I already told you in the first part of this interview is that I consider that the force of arms is needed to carry on a revolution under the conditions of our Latin American peoples. We have not only the example of Peru alone, we can also cite Panama. The armed forces have been playing a revolutionary role for a number of years, and they can carry on with it because they can count on the support of arms. If a revolutionary process is to be carried out without the support of arms, then it does not march forward. And what happens to it is what has happened in Chile. This is the lesson we can draw from the Chilean experience.
The Prime Minister then spoke about conditions in another South American country, Venezuela.
In Venezuela, certain circumstances prevail. We would speak of an elected government with a parliamentary majority that proposes to carry out some measures of nationalization, such as the nationalization of iron and the nationalization of oil. I believe that these measures enjoy great national support in Venezuela, enjoy a sense of great national sympathy. And I include among those having this national feeling the armed forces of Venezuela. I am sure that these changes, at least the measures of nationalization of iron and of oil, can perfectly well be implemented by the present government of Venezuela.
Cuba today is still a land of sugarcane and cane cutters. A Marxist society, but it's Marxism with a Caribbean beat. The Castro system has survived and in many important ways has succeeded because of hard work and dedication among his followers, ruthlessness in dealing with dissent, skyrocketing world sugar prices, and massive assistance from the Soviet Union. Soviet equipment as well as ideas abound. But Cubans insist that their revolution remains their own. Que linda es Cuba, they sing. How beautiful Cuba is. A kind of unofficial national song of the revolution. The revolution's roots are in the countryside. This is where the tropical growth called Castroism began and where it has taken deepest hold. But centuries of poverty and backwardness combined with peasant resistance to change are not easily overcome. Castro himself acknowledges poverty still exists. The influence of Cuba's past, Spanish, African, and North American, remains strong. What Castro has done is to graft onto Cuban culture a special blend of Marxism and the old traditions. Confidence is increasing among its leaders that the experiment has succeeded and that it will eventually spread like a kind of jungle ivy to other Latin American countrysides. As one mark of success, they point to housing. Concrete apartment blocks are Castro's pride. He claims a boom in new apartment construction. 10% of every industry's labor force works in construction. Office managers learning carpentry,
bus drivers becoming stonemasons, and so on. Amateur builders in what the revolution calls micro-brigades. There is still a housing shortage, but outside authorities agree that for many Cubans, housing is better now than before. And revolution leaders point to apartments already built as proof that, when it comes to housing, they have at least given the average worker hope. Schools are where the revolution has made the most dramatic, immediate improvements. Free schools now for every child, mandatory attendance, heavy emphasis on basics, especially mathematics and language skills. Teenagers do manual labor as well as their lessons in what are called work-study schools, built near factories and farms. Among students at all levels, constant ideological indoctrination. If there is a privileged class in Cuba today, besides Communist Party officials, it is the children. The revolution organizes and lavishes care on children from birth onward, as in this summer camp. Birth control aids are available, but the government does not have an official position on population control. Health care for everyone is paid for by the state. Infant mortality rates, it is claimed, now are only slightly above those for the United States. Racial harmony is another area in which the revolution claims great progress. Racial discrimination is illegal. Some race prejudice may remain, but what a visitor sees is whites, mulattoes, and blacks intermingling at all levels with no apparent tensions. Churches still exist, but the government discourages religion. The few Cubans who go to church now are mostly older people. Catholicism and priests no longer are the moral authorities. Communism and its disciples are. Privately owned industry, businesses, and most other property have been nationalized, including what was in 1960 over $2 billion in U.S. investments. Now, as before the revolution, sugar is the country's main export, its largest earner of cash. When the United States sought to make Castroism collapse in 1960 by withdrawing its quota and price agreements, the Soviets moved in. They agreed to buy the sugar and to make favorable loans. Cuban sugar production has fluctuated all during the revolutionary years. The 1959 pre-Castro 5.5 million tons was nearly matched last year. This year, Cubans are hoping for 6 million tons, of which the Soviets will buy about a third. The world sugar shortage of the past couple of years and resulting high prices have helped Cuba. But Castro's hopes of ridding Cuba of its dependence on the single crop by diversifying agriculture while industrializing have failed. Too little skilled labor and machinery. The Soviets still ship in aid in amounts averaging $1.5 million a day. That's expensive, but Cubans argue not nearly as expensive as Vietnam has been for the United States, and the Soviets' money has achieved a goal, a showcase for socialism in Latin America. The showcase includes one of the largest, best-equipped, best-trained armies in Latin America. The army is a combination of compulsory 3 years military training for all men, Soviet weapons, plus Cuban and North Vietnamese guerrilla tactics. What is not a showcase are the shortages. No newspapers or magazines other than those published under government control. A shortage of variety in books in the bookstores, and some shortages in basic consumer goods. In general, people look reasonably well clothed and well fed, but many items are rationed. Meat, for example, and milk. The rationing does appear to be more an inconvenience than a hardship. Experimental elections began this year. For the first time since the arrival of Castroism, voting was allowed for neighborhood representatives. In one province, Matanzas. Similar elections in other provinces are scheduled over the next 2 years. No plans have been announced for voting on national leaders. Among the things that puzzle other communists and make them a bit uneasy about Marxism Castro style are remnants of what Moscow and Peking consider to be capitalistic decadence. These are seen in Havana's Tropicana nightclub, for instance. The floor show has a cast of hundreds, runs 5 hours, rarely ends until after 2 a.m. The night I watched the Tropicana show, the few Russians in the audience sat through it in silence and with looks of disbelief. Cuban working people got treated to the Tropicana occasionally as a reward for excellent production. They now also can go to other bars and restaurants once reserved for the more affluent. That is what the revolution is supposed to be about, taking people from the bottom and putting them on top. Ernest Hemingway often drank in this bar. Faded photos of movie stars still line the walls. Rita Hayworth, Errol Flynn. Music from the States still permeates, still floats over, around, and through the cane cutters' revolution. But the cultural presence from the North, once dominant, has, like the movie stars' pictures, begun to fade. The large hotels, once exclusively American fun places, now provide pleasure mostly for Cuban honeymooners. Time has gone by. 15 years. In our interview, I asked Dr. Castro about reports he still holds many Cuban political prisoners.
Actualmente en Cuba quedan aproximadamente...
At present in Cuba, there remain about 20% of the counter-revolutionary prisoners that we took in the first years of the revolution. 80% have been released through various plans. We freed them. We released 80%. We did not put any condition on anyone to release them. We believe that they could be released. There are some prisoners that we do not believe can be released as yet. It is a moral issue, a question of justice, not a question of negotiation.
How are your own elections coming along? You had what I believe you called a pilot program in the Manassas province earlier. How did that election go, and will there be other elections soon?
En realidad, las elecciones marcharon perfectamente bien.
Actually, the elections went perfectly well. There was great participation. More than 90% of the population took part in these elections, and the experiment is going perfectly well. We intend to analyze all the results and to apply these same principles nationally. In a year, more or less, we shall be able to collect the results of this experience, and then in 1975, at the end of the year, we will hold the first Congress of the party. The party Congress will decide on this, and it is very possible that in 1976, this procedure will be applied to the entire country, to all the provinces, to all the country. The revolution is very much consolidated. The revolution is much more secure. For many years, the revolution had to fight for survival. The revolution has succeeded in surviving. And now, it marches on at a marvelous pace, and we can fulfill these tasks of giving the Cuban state a definitive form.
During the discussion of the elections, Castro was asked, assuming more elections are held, local and national, what will be the eventual role of the Communist Party?
The party gives the direction to the state and to the whole society. It holds the supreme political command. This will be the role, the function of the party, which will have to be recognized in the constitution itself. This will be included in the constitutional precepts of the country. The party's role, that is. Because the party will play a political role, a role of uniting the people, of educating the people, of guiding the people, and including the guiding of the state. It is true that we are trying to enable the individual to feel the greatest freedom possible. Of course, we are opposed to the criterion of interfering in the personal life of people, even though the revolution assigns many tasks to everyone and gives a lot of work to all, because the students have a lot of work. For example, they work in production, they study, participate in cultural, artistic, and sports activities. In brief, they have not a minute free during the day. Women do a great deal of work as workers, as members of the Federation of Women, as housewives,
And besides, they are members of the CDR, and if they are also active members of the party, they have a lot of activities. Besides, they also belong to the trade unions. I hear that people are complaining, for example, that the teachers have a lot of work in the schools, with the programs, the teachers' union, the women, many meetings. So I must say, in truth, that everyone here has many social obligations and many political obligations.
During the July interview, Premier Castro was asked if an opposition group could publish a newspaper in Cuba.
No, in reality, no. We're starting with one idea, that the newspapers here belong to the workers. We are starting out with the idea that there is a social order that holds office by coercion in the name of the majority, and in reality, our concept doesn't allow the existence of press organs of class enemies of the revolution to publish against the revolution. This is our concept. They are weapons which we do not make available to the enemies of the revolution. We certainly think so. I don't ask that they agree with our manner of thinking, but we have nothing to conceal and nothing to keep secret. We conceive the revolution theoretically as a process of the dictatorship of the exploited against the exploiters.
He was asked, could there be opposition?
It is so that there exists no opposition in the known classical sense to which you are referring. There can be opposition. It is acted out within the party, within the party. It can be acted out within its mass organization. It can be acted out within the factories, but not as a nationally organized party representing one class. There is the right to give an opinion. There is the right to disagree. But when the majority agrees on a specific decision, the minority must submit to the decision of the majority.
No American who has listened to and watched this broadcast should have any illusions. Make no mistake, Cuba is a communist dictatorship and gives every indication of remaining so. From all outward indications, at least, the overwhelming majority of the Cuban people want it that way. They are proud of their accomplishments in economic improvement and social reform. They are confident and well-armed, militarily and ideologically. They may want to loosen their ties with the Soviet Union. They do not want to lose them. They are determined to somehow erode United States influence throughout Latin America. At the same time, Castro and his people have respect for, need for, American production know-how and technology. Those are among the reasons that Castro is considering some new basis for his relations with the United States. For the United States, the possible advantages would appear to be less tangible, but perhaps no less important. For one thing, the present U.S. policy has not so much isolated Castro as it has the United States from public opinion in Latin America. An increasing number of people are asking, what is the point of trying to boycott Cuba, only 90 miles from our shores, while entering an era of detente with Russia and China? It is also true that for many Americans, there remains a determination to some way, somehow, keep a tough, hardline policy against communism in the hemisphere. These are by no means all of the considerations. They are some of the considerations in the building debate over whether, and if so, exactly how and when, the United States should adopt a new policy toward the new Cuba. For CBS Reports, Dan Rather in Havana, Cuba. Good night.